This is Emergency Medicine Match Advice, sponsored by Academic Life and Emergency Medicine, a podcast series designed to help medical students and residents strategically navigate the process of applying for residency in emergency medicine or to EM-sponsored fellowship programs. I'm your host, Mike Gisanti from Stanford University. Let's get started.
All right, welcome to Emergency Medicine Fellowship Match Advice, a new Google Hangout web series sponsored by Academic Life and Emergency Medicine, and its editor-in-chief, my online partner in crime, Dr. Michelle Lin from the University of California, San Francisco. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, I feel like we're the Bonnie and Clyde combo, and hello from the West Coast.
I'll always be your Clyde. This is the second episode in our new EM Match Advice spin-off series world, Fellowship Match Advice. So today's topic is entitled EM Match Advice for Ultrasound Fellowship. And to offer their sage advice on matching to an ultrasound fellowship, we have two outstanding fellowship directors, Dr. J. Christian Fox from the University of California, Irvine. He's the Assistant Dean of Student Affairs, the Vice Chair of Academic Affairs, and of course, the Ultrasound Fellowship Director. All ultrasound fellowship directors become assistant deans and vice chairs, right?
Absolutely. That's right.
There we go. We took away your punchline for later. And then, so welcome. Thanks, Chris. And Dr. Jeremy Boyd from Vanderbilt University. He is the Associate Fellowship Director and the Assistant Program Director from the Residency Program. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, guys. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I think this is going to be a great discussion about how to match to an ultrasound fellowship. So let's kick it off with Dr. Fox, and let's start, you know, from 30,000 foot view. Why would someone choose to do an ultrasound fellowship?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I asked myself that question 15 years ago when I was debating on doing an ultrasound fellowship. It was a new thing back then, and my reason back then, I think, is probably the same reason a lot of people have today, which is, hey, this is a cool academic niche for me to try to land a job in academic medicine. And I think a lot of residents experience academic medicine. That's all they know about emergency medicine. They're in residency, and there's teachers everywhere, and it's very social, and there's research projects going on. They get really involved in residency and academics, and they get excited about staying in that environment. And I went to my residency director, Dr. Langdorf, back then and said, hey, I want to stay in academics, man. I'd love to work here someday. What should I do? He said, well, you should do a fellowship, first of all. That'll give you a leg up on your competition. I said, okay, great. What should I do? Tox, peds, EMS, you know, hyperbarics, you name it, I'll run out and do it. I don't care. I just want to stay in academics. He said, we should do ultrasound. And I said, okay, ultrasound. Now, why would I do an ultrasound fellowship? They have fellowships in that? And he said, yeah, you know, it's kind of a new thing. And there's this one in Chicago I heard about the other day on some, I went to some conference, somebody was talking about it. He goes, you know, I really think that'd be pretty cool to have that here, have somebody with some expertise here in ultrasound. And I thought, well, okay. And I went and applied, and there was a program. I went and interviewed at it. And then next thing I know, I moved to Chicago to do an ultrasound fellowship and was the third person to do Mike Lambert's fellowship at Christ Hospital. And it did serve that purpose in academic, definitely in academics. It gave me that niche, that research niche, that area of focus, not just a clinical skill, but also an area that I could really focus on for research and for teaching and education and geek out on what's become a really online foam-us world with ultrasound. So, yeah, that was the best advice single-handedly anybody has ever given me in my entire life was Mark Langdorf telling me to do an ultrasound fellowship. Changed my whole world. So I think that's one reason why somebody would do an ultrasound fellowship to have a niche in academic medicine. But there's a whole other reason, and that's a clinical reason. And that's because, let's say they know that they're not going to stay in academics. They're going to go to a community job, and they want to have an area in that community job that they have their area of expertise in, and gives them a leg up on the competition maybe of getting a job and saying, hey, look, I've done this ultrasound fellowship. I know you guys are ripe to have an ultrasound program here at Community Hospital X. Maybe it's in a giant contract management group, and some of my fellowship graduates have gone on to do just that, and they direct an ultrasound program. They get some buy-down time for that. Maybe they take a little bit of the proceeds that come with ultrasound billing. They take a percentage of that. The more successful they are getting the people up and off the ground with credentialing and starting an ultrasound program with machine maintenance and image archival and reporting and all that stuff, eventually there's some billing that comes from that. And if they set it up right, maybe they get a little piece of the pie, so to speak, from the ultrasound billing. And that serves as a financial reason to do, actually, an ultrasound fellowship. Not only is it great for patient care and reduces errors and improves throughput and all those sorts of things, but could be a nice niche, not just in academics, but I think also in community emergency medicine. So it's sort of a safe bet coming from residency and saying, well, I'd sure like to do a fellowship. Which one should I do? Yeah. Maybe this ultrasound fellowship, it could work in either academics or community medicine. And there's a third reason, actually, as I was thinking about this question, not to monopolize the call here, but, you know, a third reason, and, you know, this was another reason for me personally that I wanted to do the fellowship, was that I did a 3-year emergency medicine residency program, and I only ranked 4-year programs with one exception, UC Irvine, and that's where I matched. And so at some point in the back of my head, I kind of knew I wanted to have a little more time in the oven, so to speak. And doing a fellowship was a nice way to sort of be around more supervision and attendings. And it was a nice, that year I think I matured a lot clinically, transitioned me from straight residency to being able to be a little more self-propelled. I think that extra year really was very helpful for me, clinically, actually. So that's another reason.
That's great. So what I took away from that is do what Mark Langdorf tells you to do, which
yes.
I think is really sound advice. And you should move to Chicago to learn the latest and greatest things, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's true, too. Yes. Chicago's
I didn't really hear much more than that. And 4 years is great. I heard that, too. All right. So that was sort of the I know. Yeah. I agree with you on all those points. Give us sort of the lay of the land for ultrasound fellowships. Are they generally 1 year, 2 year? Are there options? Will that change, perhaps, if accreditation is coming down the road for ultrasound? Imagining someone's watching this perhaps a couple years from now. What's sort of your take?
Yeah, I would say that the fellowships, generally speaking, that I'm aware of are in the large part 1 year fellowship. Okay. You get paid a salary to work clinical shifts and at a reduced rate. The department that you're working for pockets the rest of it, and that's the motivation, frankly, to have a fellowship structure, is that we pay the fellows, you know, my program, $80,000 when all is said and done. What they generate clinically amounts to a lot more than that. So that's the motivation for the department to take 50% of that over the 80K. They get 50% and they give the other 50% to the fellowship director per fellow. And so that's kind of the structure, how we have it structured here financially is here at UC Irvine. And the fellowships are not ACGME approved right now. And there's a concern by many that should the fellowships become this ACGME track thing, that it would be harder to that structure I just talked to you about, billing for, you know, Medicare patients and all that stuff would be difficult with Medicare patients and with being ACGME approved. And so there's a little concern there. There's some ways around that. But every time I go to my ACGME office, I'm being told that the way it works here at UC Irvine is that it's very simple to have it non-ACGME approved. So I think that there is a push in the country by many to try to change this over to an ACGME structure, and there's some that are concerned about that because they may not be able to offer the same package during the recruitment process.
I know very little about sort of the current state of affairs in ultrasound, so why we have the experts here, but you know, my impression was this was perhaps the next subspecialty in many ways, or at least that's sort of the groundswell that folks really want to see ultrasound become its own awarded subspecialty.
Right. And I, in many ways, I agree with that. I think that it would make it really legit if we had this board certification for ultrasound, at least in an academic sense. So there are reasons to do that. The downsides would be a lot more paperwork with a PIF and everything, and we'd have to have a dedicated coordinator. And I think that while it would, for a lot of fellowships, it would really add a lot of structure to them, and really bring a rising tide brings all the boats up, or whatever that comment is. I think that would happen to some degree.
Sure.
But there's some fellowships that wouldn't survive under that structure.
Yeah.
And for a variety of reasons. One is that you may not be able to pay them as much. They'd be paid as a PGY-4, PGY-5, and so that salary gets set, and it would be maybe harder to recruit as many people into the field if they, you know, we couldn't offer higher, you know, non-ACGME salaries. So that's one of the arguments against doing it. And then of course, they couldn't be able to bill for certain types of patients in certain institutions. Now, there's ways around that, I've heard, but not in the UC system. It would be very difficult, I think, for us to have the current structure.
All right. So,
Sorry, Mike. Just because I don't know very much about this, and I get this question a lot, which is people interested in the Ultrasound Fellowship until it becomes more accredited of any sort. Your thoughts, both of you guys, on the RDMS certification, kind of some external body label certificate. Thoughts on that? Do it, don't do it?
That's a great question, Michelle, because that issue is kind of at the heart of this kind of what are we trying to do with establishing this idea of this clinical sonologist, which is really nowadays is different, I think, from what the actual RDMS certification is. I'll be honest, I have my RDMS, and from a purely pragmatic standpoint, it's very helpful in terms of dealing with folks perhaps outside of the academic emergency medicine realm. Like, I work clinically at the VA. When I'm interacting with some of those colleagues at a national level, and they say, oh, he's got his RDMS, it suddenly means so much more. But really what it is it's a technician's skill set. It's very different from what we teach in clinical ultrasound fellowships, where people are actually integrating ultrasound and point-of-care ultrasound into their clinical practice and using clinical judgment. So the RDMS, I'd say, while it certainly gives a certain stamp of technical ability, and the test itself does involve the physics core test that you have to take for RDMS, I think is the easiest and most kind of compact way of getting something that's a very standardized and an effective test of knowledge for physics. But the actual clinical things like abdomen, echocardiography, PEDS echo, MSK, I think all of that is really, it's kind of fringe things, and it can be pragmatically useful, but we leave that really up to our fellows, and the national organizations have sort of said that they feel like that is something that we should no longer require or necessarily endorse, because it doesn't really get at what we mean when we say that someone has completed an ultrasound a fellowship in clinical ultrasound.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you, Jeremy, that historically it was a nice bridge. You know, you talk to somebody, they say, wait a minute, you know, you're an ER doctor, but you do ultrasound? What does that mean? To a hospital administrator, they're confused by this. They're like, does this guy know what he's talking about? You know, looking around the room. Right. And I'm like, I'm also a registered diagnostic medical sonographer. I'm an ultrasound tech as well, so... And for whatever reason, that had a lot of weight and still does in some certain circumstances, even though the test itself, I wouldn't call it difficult or challenging. It is a nice way to formalize some of the physics teaching, and that's why I do encourage my fellows to do it, because you do have to kind of study for a few days for the physics component of it. I agree. But the test itself is such a tiny little drop in the bucket of what we do with clinical ultrasound. So in many ways, it's not relevant, and frankly, ASEP has been, saying, "Hey, we don't need another hoop to jump through, right? We shouldn't hold everybody to this weird tech standard that doesn't really relate to clinical ultrasound." But Jeremy's right; you throw it around a little bit in certain circles, and it gets you where you need to go politically into a certain situation. And and frankly, it's nice to kind of have a little bit of kinship with the sonographers. I work with sonographers a ton now in medical education. They help me teach the medical students, and so I have a little bit of street cred with them, and there's some of that that goes down. But I think it's okay. It's not harmful. It's not like a negative thing, but it's kind of fringy. Some of it's a little bit fringy.
I think Mike and Michelle, I think what you're going to see is in the next 2 years, there's going to be some real kind of come to Jesus moment with ultrasound fellowship and this kind of accreditation process, and whether we're going to be a board certified subspecialty or whether it's going to be something new within the American Board of Medical Specialties, like something akin to having some kind of certificate like a hospitalist or advanced echocardiographers or something like that. I think there's going to be some big decisions made, and I think the people who are applying to fellowship should be aware of that. That really here in the next two to 5 years, let's be honest, it's academic medicine, there's going to be some big decisions made as far as what kind of standards we're going to set, and are we going to have our own test, and how are we going to accredit? But a lot of that's yet to be determined.
All right. Well, let's switch gears for a minute and talk about life after fellowship and talk about jobs. So Dr. Boyd, what are the job opportunities like right now? Pulse of the job market. Good, bad, ugly.
Beautiful. Good, bad, beautiful, all of it. And what I would say, so most what we're seeing now is this is going to be a theme, I guess, is everything's evolving. The old pathway, I don't want to say old, but 15 years ago for the more skilled and advanced and, say, assistant deans of us, the pathway of you go into your ultrasound fellowship and you come out and you're going to go somewhere and be an ultrasound director at a residency program. I think that pathway itself is that is becoming more and more rare. And part of that is that the field itself has developed. It's really hard to go straight out of residency into a fellowship and then be in charge of an ultrasound, an entire academic ultrasound division at a residency program. I think that's, there are certainly lots of skilled people who are doing it, but I think that's becoming more and more rare, partly because a lot of those jobs have already been taken. So I think what people are doing, the field has become so broad that people are now developing their own niches. So there's definitely still lots of jobs out there within ultrasound divisions and academic emergency ultrasound divisions, but they tend to kind of, you got to kind of choose your niche within that. So you might be the research person, or you might be the medical student person, or maybe your niche is kind of tying in global health and emergency ultrasound. So I think you're seeing more of that kind of sub-specialization within the field as far as academic positions go. And then in addition to that, there's all kinds of, I mean, I think Chris talked about this already, but there's all kinds of opportunities within community hospitals and private hospital groups and large corporate groups who need people who can be this kind of high level, both be a clinician and take care of patients, but also help to manage some of the more advanced kind of billing, the turf battles. And then even there's opportunities, I'm sure, that are out there in industry and some of the private industry jobs. Most of those have gone to folks who have had sort of longer careers in emergency ultrasound, but some people do eventually kind of go into that, whether it's device design or consulting with somebody like GE or Sonosight being the obvious one that comes to mind. A lot of people do kind of branch into that direction. So while the vast majority of it is still academic emergency medicine, I think there's a whole nother realm of opportunity for the community private hospital groups that are out there.
Yeah, and there's really not a great example of that in our specialty, right? I mean, I think a lot of the subspecialists in emergency medicine tend to stay at academic shops, and I think most of the residents who are considering doing a fellowship, in their mind, they're like, okay, I have to stay in academics forever. Yeah. Where, you know, that's not the same in medicine or surgery, where you can go to a cardiology fellowship with zero intention of staying in academic and have a very successful and productive career in the community. And this might be one of those few examples, really, that I can think of for emergency medicine where, you know, there's clearly another path.
So, Mike, I'm just looking through the list of all of my fellow graduates here on this side of the screen here, and I've graduated 22 fellows now from my fellowship.
Wow.
And I'm looking at it, and it looks like a lot of them, and I have their current position as I go down here, you know, associate ED director, chair of emergency department, director of emergency ultrasound, a lot of that, ED director, and then there's probably 25% of them end up in academics as fellowship directors or director of emergency ultrasound. One of them became an associate dean in instructional technology. And by the way, Michelle, he said hi to you. Dr. Warren Weekman said hi to you. He knew I was going to be on the call with you today. And another one became a research director, an assistant residency director. So some of them do go into academics, but a lot of them end up in community medicine. Probably 75% of my graduates have gone on and ended up in the community directing ultrasound programs and then taking other leadership positions within that group as well. For me, just speaking personally for a second, the fellowship gave me a chance to start a medical student ultrasound rotation, which evolved into this process where now I have a four-year medical student ultrasound curriculum, and I worked a lot with the deans of the curriculum to make that happen. And then somebody, the students sort of got to know me, and then somebody said, hey, you should be in student affairs, and it kind of led to my that was my stepping stone into the dean's office to be an assistant dean of student affairs, and so, which has nothing to do with ultrasound or emergency medicine, but certainly yet another hat. But I feel like that's been such a fun job to do and to grow in that position. I've really learned a lot about just how medical schools work. Mm-hmm. And you kind of get into all these committees where they're discussing all kinds of stuff that you learn how the down and dirty of how a medical school just runs from top to bottom. So, but I wouldn't have been doing that job if it wasn't for teaching ultrasound to medical students and having that role. And I wouldn't have that role had I not done the fellowship. So that was the pathway that leads to for me. And what kind of what Jeremy was saying, like, yeah, you know, I mean, there's all these different opportunities and roles that this could open up for you. And we see this a lot with industry as well. There, industry, the different companies are looking for to partner up and channel up with people in academics to help them develop their products, which is a really fun and exciting place to be as well.
And that should be sort of the next set of opportunities. At some point, everybody's going to have an ultrasound director. right? Like, we're going to hit a critical mass if we haven't already hit it, at least to the academic institutions. So then it's a question of building divisions of ultrasound and how many ultrasound faculty do you need at certain places before you have enough. I think that's a hard and probably loaded question to some degree. But then eventually there'll be enough, right? So are there endless jobs? And then where are those jobs if they're not in academics? And it's great to hear that there's a plethora of other opportunities, because much like SIM, for a while, no one knew how to turn the robots on. Now pretty much everybody's got that one person who can turn the robots on. That used to be ultrasound when I was junior resident. Can anyone turn the machine on, push the buttons a lot? You know, now people generally can. So what does the aspiring ultrasound grad, you know, where do they have to go if not academics? And it's interesting to hear some of those options.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it starts with them being ultrasound directors coming on and then people seeing how their leadership skills there and how they've been able to successfully manage those programs. And they say, hey, you know, there's an opening in the hospital for this chief medical officer. You've done such a great job pointing care ultrasound, not just in the emergency department, but I mean, you've been leading this charge throughout the whole hospital.
Yeah.
With machine purchase and working with 12 different departments using point of care ultrasound. We're going to send you off to this chief medical officer's training camp. It's a 2-year kind of certificate thing. You go do it. Next thing you know, ultrasound led you to this CMO position. So I think it can benefit you in a lot of different ways because it's so clinically driven. It's not just a research academic thing, but it can be a very clinically driven entrance into other leadership positions in the hospital.
Jeremy, what do you think?
No, I totally agree with Chris. I forgot to mention, too, that there's a whole slew of assistant deanships out there, too, for people going into the academic medicine world, I'm sure.
Well, right. Now, the medical schools are starting to pick up what we knew 10 years ago, and they all need faculty that are perhaps not just emergency physicians.
Yeah, and seriously, you know, in all seriousness, I think there is some truth to that, because what we're seeing now is not only are we just the emergency ultrasound, but we're becoming really the clinical ultrasound evangelists. Ultimately, where people are serving in these hospital-wide committees as the you know head of point of care ultrasound, or the you know interdisciplinary committees that have multiple people who are using ultrasound, whether it's internal medicine, you know hospitalists, intensivists. Dave Boehner, I think, is another you know guy, obviously at Ohio State, a big medical student ultrasound person. I think he's got a joint appointment in his titles that's like in the Department of Urology. So you've got all kinds of people that are working interdisciplinary and all the various factions within the House of Medicine. So I think the fact that it's clinically based makes it very easy to sort of bridge that divide with whatever specialty you're dealing with.
All right, so Jeremy, one last question about jobs. A lot of what you've both described are, I think, the paths of the trailblazer, right? And a lot of folks who enter ultrasound fellowships, still, they're kind of the trailblazers. You know, most programs aren't Irvine. They don't have 25 graduates. They have a few graduates. And, you know, I think you've harnessed a lot of that energy, enthusiasm, and talent to go into this field. But some people don't want to be the CMO. They're going to be good with ultrasound directors. So what does an average ultrasound director do? And even like an ultrasound director in a big community hospital where you're going to be super important, but maybe not academic. Like, what is that job description? What does that mean to be the ultrasound director?
It's a great question because it's going to look different, unfortunately, or fortunately for the purposes of the question. It's going to look different, I think, depending on where you are. So I still think there's going to be a big difference between somebody who's in academic emergency medicine and somebody who's in community emergency medicine as far as the specific roles that you're going to have there. There's always going to be an educational component, and that's probably going to be one of the biggest flex components depending on where you are. That can be critical if you're at a community shop where nobody knows how to use the ultrasound. You're just trying to get everybody to figure out how to do a fast in trauma. On the other hand, if you're somewhere that's got a very established residency program, you're looking at not just fellow education, but sort of the progression of your residents through all the various skill sets. So that's going to be something that flexes a lot. There's always going to be a primary responsibility for quality assurance. And that's the big part, because ultimately that's where the buck stops as far as, are we doing this right? Are we being smart about this? Are we being safe? Are we making the right calls here based on the images that we're obtaining and the patients that we're seeing? So that really, I think, gets at the kernel. That, I mean, if you want to talk about where the ultimate responsibility falls in terms of an ultrasound division, it's going to fall to that person who's going through everything and saying, you know, we're doing a good job here, but we're really missing this key part of the exam when we're doing the basic echo. So we need to start making sure that people know about this and are basically taking accountability for it. And then you're always going to have things like, depending on whether or not your department bills, the billing and managing some of the finances and things that come with that, the budget for the department. And then last but definitely not least, you are the go-to mechanic for just about any IT / ultrasound. You know, someone calls, I can't find the power button, I can't download this image, I can't, you know, it's broken or it's speaking Swahili to me, help me, how do I figure out this machine? That is definitely your job as well.
If you're I may have sent those emails at one point.
I got a call just the other day. I mean, somebody's like, yeah, I was using the machine, and this is, and you get these screenshots nowadays where it's just, here's the error message. And then you might get a text 5 minutes later. It says, hey, we can't figure this out. What's going on?
You know, here's my theory though, right? Like, I write some really good emails, but I'm not so good at like making Outlook do what I want it to do. And that's where my coordinator is really helpful. So I'm pretty good at getting those images, but there's lots of fields to fill out and buttons.
Yep.
Buttons are overwhelming. Chris is just laughing at me, so let's get him to talk about something else. Let's talk about the actual application process, nuts and bolts. How does one apply for a fellowship? Give me the timeline. When do you start getting your foot in the pond here, and when do decisions get made?
So it's never too early to start the process. I love it when someone comes up to me at some conference somewhere and says, hey, I'm a first-year resident, second-year resident, whatever. It's way too early to even talk about this, but I am really interested in doing an ultrasound fellowship. Here's my card. Here's my name. Could I email you? Whatever. They connect up with me somehow, and they ask me, they make up some question they want to ask, and then they go into that question, and then, you know, we're chatting. And I think that's great. That's like, that shows this. Then I see them again at another conference, and then again, and then I know who they are. They're just this person who's super into it. I'm like, we should come out to UCI and spend a few days, and you know, we'll go, we'll have some laughs, we'll get some journal club going on the boat, you know, we'll have a good time with this,
We're gonna get to that later.
So there's no, so by the way, it's a buyer's market right now with ultrasound. So from the applicant standpoint,
oh yeah,
they're hot commodities, and it's very different than it was even 5 years ago, I think. So
yeah. And by buyer's market, you mean there are way more spots than there are applicants.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
How many spots go unfilled? Give me your sense.
Gosh, I don't know exactly. Someone threw a number out recently. There's somewhere around 75 or 80 fellowships now. Each one takes, some of them take up to two or three or four, even four fellows. So, you know, you're looking at around 100 spots or more, sometimes as much as 150 spots. Maybe there's 75 in the mix out there applying or so. So I get, I just checked my stats on emergencyultrasound.com, EOS fellowships, sorry, not emergencyultrasound.com, EOSfellowships.com, and EOSfellowships.com, that's where they all go, and I think I have 14 applicants right now on there. I get a little message notification, someone has applied your fellowship, and I go in there, and
I don't know what, Michelle and I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay,
is it
so,
like ERIS? There's a, what do you do?
Yeah, it's kind of like that, it's EOSfellowships.com, and okay, it's a whole application service that was started, I think, by Romolo Gaspari and some others. And as a fellowship director, I got to pay, I forgot, I think it's $100 a year or something. I don't know, actually. My administrator takes care of it. But if there's a fee every year, it's a way for all the fellowships to be represented on there. And people go in and they can read all about my program. That I'm very careful with. I brand it, I update it, I make sure that it's it changes every year, so I change the curriculum on there, I have it all as best I can, keep it updated, and that's how people find me. They go through there and they see, oh, here's this fellowship, this is where it's located, this is the curriculum, this is about their department. There's a lot of data on there about my program, and then they apply, and they upload their CV, their personal statement, and then people who write letters of recommendations for them upload those letters. I click into their application, and it's awesome. I can see, I mean, their contact information's on there. I immediately go straight to the CV, and I see what their pedigree is. Where did they go to college? Where did they go to medical school? Where are they doing their residency?
You have to use ultrasound people to figure out what all the other non-ACGME fellowships can't seem to do. So that's awesome. And what was the website again?
EUSfellowships.com.
And that has all the instructions. Okay.
So
when does one start that application?
Can't be too soon, but it can be too late. So I just got another app. Today is September or something,
29.
I got a application 2 days ago, actually. And I'm like, whoo, this is late because I've already interviewed half the people on that list. And I interviewed someone yesterday, interviewed someone most of today. I've got someone coming tomorrow. and this is prime time right now. I try to get them done before ASAP, and whoever can't come out here to Irvine and interview for the day with me here, I end up spending maybe an hour with at ASAP, and that's not as good as someone coming here and really interacting with them and meeting some of my faculty and talking to my fellows and going to lunch or dinner, and that's the best way to do it. So the earlier the better, because I run out of time.
I know. Yeah. All right, and then there's a match.
We have a match. It's called a no-offer date.
What's
that mean? Very confusing.
Okay.
So what has happened in the past is that right now, let's say you go through your list and you're like, oh, I totally want so-and-so and so-and-so. You call so-and-so up, say, hey, listen, let's do this. I want you to come to my program. But they're like, hey, I haven't interviewed everywhere yet. And then a fellowship director would say, well, you've got until tomorrow to say yes or no. And this is it now. This is like September. Somebody would get that kind of pressure before they had a chance to like check out all the programs.
That's life. That's the real job market.
It was, that's true. But it was a little bit too aggressive for both the applicants and the other fellowships who were sort of, coming up the pike. And so we all agreed in the emergency ultrasound community through this EUS fellowships website to say, we have a no offer date of November 19th at a certain time.
No offer before that date.
Like, I think it's 6 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Every year it's a little different. It could be 9 a.m. I'm allowed to call the first person on my list and say, hey, you want to come train at UCI? And if they say yes, I say, great, welcome aboard. Hang up the phone, immediately call the second person on my list. Hey, do you want to come train at UCI? No? Okay, good luck in the match. Take care. Call the next person on my list. Oh, I've already got called by so-and-so. So-and-so's on the line trying to get me as well. And so you're kind of doing this. You got to make these calls right at the time, and then you go down your list and you make these phone calls, and that's how we do it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right.
Until you fill.
And I assume that participation in this application service, automatically you agree to participate in this sort of, no offer date match sort of process. Are there programs outside of this match? Are there folks that don't participate?
I am not aware of any, but they must exist. They must exist, like everything else. And
the vast majority, if not all of the fellowships out there are going through this. Okay.
Frankly, it would be easier for me in some ways to just go outside the system. And right now I have an idea, and say, this is what I want. But I think it's kind of more, it's nice that this system exists because it's fun when you get somebody apply. You're like, oh, somebody applied to my fellowship. You click in there. Who is this person? You kind of figure out who they are, and you start talking to their people, wrote them letters, and you do all your due diligence. Because for me, the biggest red flag of all would be some clinical weirdness that came up during residency that I have to be careful with. So that's right. That's the next stage of this question, probably, to tell you what I really look for. But the process is nice because it's so organized, and they have a place to go to upload all their stuff. And then I have a place to go to. It's very organized. I need to see your whole application, 2 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, that is a huge service that your group of like-minded ultrasound individuals in the country came to agreement. It's great. It's outstanding.
Yeah, you've almost thrown the gauntlet down for all the other non-BME fellowship programs of like, this is really what you could do to make everybody's lives easier, both the fellowship directors and the applicants' lives. Like, you've totally bookended it, right? You've made the application process clean. You have an interview day, or I guess an accept day on you said, November 19th. I did have a question about that, which is, let's say you call them, and they're waiting for kind of their promised site that they really want to go to. Can they say, can I call you back in an hour, or do they decide on the spot, or just don't pick up the phone?
There's a rule with this, too, and I think they have up to 2 hours to answer your question, to answer your offer, maybe? I can't remember. Every year it changes a little bit. There's a little bit of little tweaks. I got to look it up. I like to really try to play by the rules so that I don't get voted off this nice island. But yeah, if somebody says, hey, can I call you back? That's happened to me a few times. I'll admit it. Yeah. They're waiting for their other. I'm not their first choice, I could tell. And I'm waiting. And, sometimes the phone never rings.
Oh, geez. No, we've all been there, right? So it reminds me of that movie Draft Day, right? Didn't that come out like a year or so ago? That was great. Yeah. Who was in that?
Kevin Costner.
Right. Jennifer Garner, right? That movie was great. Same thing. Like, they had hours, the clock's ticking, they're on ESPN. Fox, I could totally see you make a movie out of this.
It'd be
really dramatic.
Just play that up and just put it on the
screen. He's so good at it. All right.
Actually, it's an idea for a Sona Wars costume, maybe. Yeah, something a Sona Wars costume theme.
All right. Well, so another question about sort of the timing of this. I hear Jeremy describe job descriptions that might include engineer, that might include, which is, you know, sort of facetious, but, you know, certainly include educator, include QI, patient safety officer for the hospital, that include researcher. So I can imagine, particularly the academic programs, where these folks are going to have more than just a couple letters after their name. They may be getting that master's in education. They may be getting a master's of science in clinical investigation so they can do substantive funded research. You know, are they the norm? And for those, you know, whether they are the norm or not, how does this common application accept date play into that? Because a lot of these graduate programs are going to be off cycle to your agreed upon date.
Well, we have other fellowships in my institution from the emergency department that do have a lot of dual degree situations going on like that, where they get a degree, a master's in translational science. That's probably the most common one. I see a lot of people coming here and getting MBAs rolling out of here, the executive health MBAs. Sure. So I haven't done that with my fellowship yet.
Are they built into the timeline, or are they, like, is that a process that the applicant just has to do on their own?
I don't know of that many in ultrasound that do this. I think about it a lot because it would be cool to have somebody, one recruit where I didn't have to recruit for two spots every year. It would be nice to have someone stick around for 2 years and really do some deeper dives into the research stuff. A lot of good advantages there. I just haven't operationalized. It's something I've thought about. It would be cool because we have it all set up with the other fellowships here. It would be easy for me to say, hey, it's a two-year fellowship, but how would that play into the no-offer day? Yeah, that's a good question. Maybe that's a little late for that no-offer date. November is sort of late.
Yeah. Jeremy, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I think that's it's a good question. I apologize, I had some technical issues come up. But I think a lot of places, at least the ones that I know that are doing 2 years, I think some of that, they try and do that. If it's an extra master's, they might do it in the second year. And so that first year is really kind of getting your feet wet and things like that. And then you really set the plan for whatever your master's thesis is going to be. So if it's a master's in education, you might be doing that then in the second year. Or maybe even some of that happens in the first year. But it is pretty tough and difficult to operationalize that. Even if it's just as much as doing an MPH or something like that, it's tricky to operationalize that. And that, you know, that no offer date is, you know, it can complicate things. There's no question.
No, I mean, so it sounds like there's more good than bad, but I
think so.
Okay. All right. So let's stick with you, Jeremy. Let's talk about making yourself that number one on the list who gets the phone call at first round of draft day. I'm going to stick with that analogy. You know, what makes you competitive? You know, you've got 10 applicants. How do you figure out, like, oh, that should be our number one? What's unique about their application?
So I was actually, this is a great question. Ultimately, and truth be told, literature or pseudo-formal survey, it's personality and the lack of personality disorders ultimately.
So much like everything.
Yeah, exactly. So we had a meeting, Romulo Gaspari and Andrew Leteplo and some other folks put it together. There's the EUS Fellowships is now sort of the website for the Society for Clinical Ultrasound Fellowships, so SCUF. And so the first meeting for SCUF, you gotta love that, was in 2015 in Boston. And so they did a great job that in between our little didactics, they were asking these sort of survey questions ranging the gamut from, you know, how do you do your didactics to, you know, do you do 2 years, 4 year, you know, or 4 years, 5 years, 1 year, what do you do? And so 72% of people ranked personality as the most important aspect in terms of basically bringing somebody in and what they look for. So, and then after that, I think there's nothing like, it's not like nunchuck skills where you got to come in and demonstrate that you can ultrasound at a certain level. I mean, I think really for me, when I'm looking for somebody to be a fellow, I'm looking for somebody that I'm going to be able to work with, who's got a normal personality that's not going to cause issues. But then I'm also looking for letters that show that this person's got clinical ability, because when you go and you interview, you're going to be interviewed both as a fellow but also as a clinician and as, you know, potentially depending on the role and how that role plays out within the department, as junior faculty or as sort of that middle ground junior faculty fellow kind of person. But either way, you're going to be responsible for overseeing and supervising residents. And so they want to know that you've got the clinical chops to do that. So I think once you've got those down and then something that shows some kind of added oomph in ultrasound, whether that's education, whether that's a research project, whether that's you led and designed a curriculum in an international emergency department setting, something that shows you've got that extra little thing that's your little pearl that you're going to bring to the division that maybe the division doesn't have yet, or maybe that they do have, and that syncs up well with what you want to do. So,
well, that, I mean, you got my attention there at the lean in, because you know, I hear my resident say, well, gosh, you know, do I need to have, you know, my level 5 milestone attained, or do I need RDMS, or do I need X number of scans above everybody else, or do I have to do research, or do I have to go to some special training conference, or, you know, or can I just be a senior resident who decided I really like this, I want to apply? You know, what is the reality when you're telling me that there's a lot of programs out there going unfilled, it's a buyer's market? You know, how necessary is that stuff, or can we still get our senior residents who kind of get the light switch at the end and they say, you know, this is appealing to me?
I think just like emergency medicine, where you've got medical students who come in and from day one, they're emergency medicine every day, every rotation, and that's what they're doing. Oh, and, you know, you got to love them. And then you have the ones who are like, well, I like medicine, but I don't like rounding. And I like surgery because I like procedures. And then they finally do their emergency medicine rotation. They're like, holy cow, this is what I want to do. I think you've got the same thing in emergency ultrasound. I think you've got the people who come in and they went to UCI for medical school. They don't know how to manage a stethoscope. And this is not the case in UCI. They're excellent. But they know an ultrasound as much as a stethoscope in terms of the evaluations that they do with patients. And then they say, you know, I know I'm going to do emergency medicine and an emergency ultrasound fellowship. And then, yeah, you do have the people. I think now with the way the market is, I think it's okay to be somebody who's really excited about emergency ultrasound, who may not have had like a residency long mentorship in emergency ultrasound, but you've got declared skill in, you know, you've got declared, not even just skill, just resiliency and interest. So whether that's, you know, like you've sort of come up with your own project or your educational curriculum, or you thought, hey, you know, ultrasound could be better at our residency, so you helped to develop that. I think something that shows a vested interest, whether or not that's something that has gone over, you know, had an IRB sign off of it, took you across the country, I don't think it has to be that elaborate. I just think that extra something, which can be fairly straightforward, whether it's just, you know, you gave a lecture on ultrasound in coding patients or something like that, I think that's what we want to see.
Sure. I mean, you make a very strong parallel to the residency application process. Certainly there's those medical students coming from schools without an EM residency program. They're a little behind the places, like, you know, they're at the forefront of the specialty, and they certainly tier out in terms of PDs. I'm sure the same thing happens with you guys. I mean, I matched one of Chris's medical students this year, and I had to break it to him at orientation that perhaps his program director had some problems with the buttons. Deep breath. I'll teach other stuff. You know, and people are coming in with totally wide varying skill sets.
Absolutely.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I would like to add one thing. Sure. I agree with everything you guys are talking about, but I think there is one thing that. So where's the downside risk when I really like somebody and we're syncing up really well, and I'm like, oh, I want this person to be part of my family with ultrasound, and I feel like this is going to work out. Where am I going to run into some problems with this person? And that's clinically. That's how they deal with the nurses on shift. That's really how they are in the department. So I call the people to write them letters. Sometimes their program directors, though, are excited that they're going to have a resident grad is going to get into a fellowship, you know? Sure. So there's sometimes it's hard to always get a straight answer, believe it or not. But as opposed to medical students coming into residency where you're not exactly sure how they're going to perform clinically, that's not the case here. Like, I can get a pretty good, I can answer that question usually. So, and it's probably one of my, if not the biggest question I have, because it's a lot of liability here for me. If my fellow does not perform well clinically, it's a direct reflection of me to my whole program. So I have to be very, very careful here. So I'm picky at that. So one of the things I do is I call the emergency department where they work. And a nurse answers the phone and I say, hey, do you know so-and-so? And they say, yeah, who's this? I'm like, oh, I'm just recruiting them for a job, and I just want to make sure that, you know, and I kind of, sometimes it doesn't work. But if you can sort of make friends with the person on the phone, and sometimes it doesn't matter who it is. It could be the hospital unit secretary. It could be whoever picks up the phone. But sometimes I'll ask to speak to the charge nurse, and that's really the best person. If you can get a hold of the charge nurse and say, how does so-and-so, what's so-and-so like? What are they really like? You tell me. And I kind of make them laugh a little bit on the phone just to kind of soften them up. Otherwise, they're like, who's this weirdo calling me stalking
my residence?
So you got to be kind of cool about it. But, but there's a way to find out what they're really – if they just say glowing things to me, that's a third party who doesn't have any skin in the game, very objective, boom. That's what I need to hear.
What is the little phrase? Is it like sneaky like a fox? Shady like that song.
Sly. Sly Fox.
International spy work. That I'm getting mad. I've always liked Chris, but that's mad.
That's respect. A foxy move. Foxy move. Yeah.
We're just going to call it foxy. All right. So, Michelle, I've got two more very directed questions, and then it's all yours. So I'm going to do one for Chris. I'm going to tell you both your questions ahead of time. Chris, what kinds of questions should the applicants expect to get when they're on campus with you at their interviews? And then Jeremy, you're going to do the reverse and tell me what questions should the applicants be asking of these interviewers?
Okay. So I like to ask a lot of clinical questions. I say, tell me about a situation which you and a nurse had a disagreement. We all have disagreements. That's natural. It's the yin and yang of our interprofessional behaviors. Sure. Tell me about it. Give me an example of that. And if they're kind of looking for, they're thinking about it, I give them plenty of time. I say, you know what? We'll come to that question. I could tell you're kind of chewing on it. Let me ask you something a little easier here first, you know. And so I give them time, or I'll say that I'm going to ask you this question, so at least they could, because off the spot like that, you're like, geez, that one time, no, I don't want to bring that up, do I? But maybe that's important, you know. So I like to see how they handle some clinical disagreements in the emergency department. So I think that's really important to me, and I get a sense of how mature they are in those situations. And then I ask them what their experience have been with ultrasound. I say, what have you done, you know, with ultrasound? And I'm not looking for somebody who's published research in ultrasound. I'm not looking for somebody who's even good at ultrasound. I'm really looking for somebody I could sync up with. So I might ask them a couple of ultrasound soft questions, but then I'll ask them, what do they do in their free time? And that sounds like idle chit-chat. I might do it right in the beginning. Sounds like idle chit-chat in some ways, but it's actually the most important part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
What do you like to do when you're not, you know, in the hospital? Who are you? What's your deal? What makes you, what do you have fun doing? And then, you know, and they can talk about whatever their hobby is, you know, oh, I like to cook. Tell me how you cook. What do you do? You know, what's your favorite food? Whatever it is they like to do, we just dive down deep in that. And I try to, actually, you know, I try to learn as much as I can from them. In that moment, I'm spending all this time. You know, for me, I like walking away. Like today, I learned a lot about ballet, which I didn't know much about. And so I thought that was pretty cool. And normally, you know, I wouldn't have talked to somebody for 20 minutes about ballet. And so I like to, at least, how conversational are they? When I ask a question, do they jump in and interrupt me every 2 seconds and I can't get my question in? Or do they get that natural ebb and flow of a normal human being's conversation, you know? And so it's stuff like that. Are they, same thing you do with residency. Is this a normal person that I'm going to want to spend, you know, I'm very hands-on with my fellows. That sounds kind of weird. I work a lot with my fellows directly every week. In QA, we travel a lot together. There's a lot of stuff we do one-on-one or in a group of, you know, 5 or 6 people. And so I want to make sure that's somebody I want to spend all that time with.
Yeah.
That's
your boat is only so big, Chris.
She is 38 feet. Yes, we do have that. We have that limitation. Thank you. Yes.
world, FYI. All right. Yeah. So, you know, I think the theme to take away there is just interview skills, job interviewing 101, right? And you're really focusing very little on ultrasound experience. And perhaps it's just people have to have the passion, the excitement, the energy, and you can teach them the rest.
Yeah.
It's hard
absolutely.
To teach the other stuff. All right.
Yeah.
Good. I like hearing that.
Good.
All right. So now, Jeremy, you are in Chris's office. He's trying to outfox you.
All right.
Did you like that?
I do.
I just came up with that on my own.
That was nice.
Right. You've never heard that in your life, right? So what questions do you ask him to make sure that he's on the up and up, you as the applicant?
So number one, interview skills are most important. Look around. What's around Dean Fox's office? You're going to see pictures of a boat. You're going to see pictures of ballast points. Start talking about those things. Anybody who's going there, ask about the boat.
That's right. No,
in all seriousness, so when you're going to a fellowship, you want to know there's a whole spread of different kinds of fellowships. I mean, there really are. People have different curriculums. They have different opportunities. So you want to know, so when I come and I'm not working as an ultrasound fellow, because some of that ultimately is just going to be, you're going to show up, somebody's going to hand you an ultrasound probe, and they're going to say, all right, you know, go scan some people. And there's, in some regards, there are places that might be kind of how the fellowship is. So it's very much the impetus is on the fellows to really, you know, get the scans in, to do the ultrasound, to do some of the teaching, and to kind of run the education aspect. And then there are other fellowships where the weekly, on a daily basis, you're going to have some kind of schedule where Mondays are the division days where you scan as a division and you're going to have classes, and then Tuesdays will be your day of clinical shifts, and then Wednesday you're going to be in another, you know, you're going to be doing your independent scanning, and then you're going to be doing your research work in the afternoon. Some places, you know, do have kind of more of a formula like that. It's tougher to do that, obviously, because all of our clinical schedules are different and are going to have some variety, but there's definitely a spectrum between everything is planned out and very little is planned out, and so, and therefore maybe more flexible. So you want to know, go ahead.
I was going to say, we'll drill down then to what would be a red flag, right? Because it sounds like there's a lot of variety and that's okay, right. But what should make your bells go off that maybe that's not the thing that I really need to hear?
So you really want to make sure that you're going to have the mentorship available to both improve in terms of the image acquisition, and but then also in terms of your clinical integration. So image acquisition comes with practice and with time, but you need a little bit of feedback, both sort of tactile, verbal, and visual. And at first, you want somebody who's going to be spending time with you, doing scanning shifts with you, kind of helping you, hand-holding or hands-on work, as Fox says, basically helping you to get those images that you need. And then you're going to want something. Everybody does a range. Some people have, it's really a 50-50 split from what we know. Same meeting, we discussed this. Some people have a planned out didactic curriculum. Some people don't. But what you want to know is that you're going to have the opportunity to learn the skills that you need to sort of meet the, what's known, I mean, it's published in Academic Emergency Medicine, the core content of clinical ultrasonography, to kind of how are you going to get those scans that you need to get. The baseline is you need to do 1,000 scans in fellowship. So are fellows actually doing that? I think those are some of the big things you want to be on the lookout for. And I mean, the red flags really are, you know, what are your former fellows doing? If nobody's doing anything in ultrasound, that's probably a bad sign. But not necessarily. I think the other things that you really need to ask about are just, there's all kinds of additional opportunities out there. So you're going to get a chance maybe to interact with, whether it's sort of local emergency academic ultrasound leaders, if it's, you know, everybody, it seems like every department or group is affiliated with some kind of CME institution where you're teaching ultrasound courses, whether that's some of the big ones are, the group I work with is Third Rock, but then there's other groups out there like, you know, John Kendall's got his Denver, I'm sure, Fox, I don't know what group actually you work with, and, you know, Mike and Matt of Ultrasound Podcast have their whole slew of exotic locations where they'll do CME. Are you going to have an opportunity as a fellow to go and help out with those kind of things? Because those are a lot of fun to do in fellowship, yeah. To travel and do that. And then you're going to want to know, research is a requirement. So what kind of research has been done? Are you expected to have your IRB proposal ready when you start fellowship? Because some places do that. Or is it more that, you know, you're kind of going to get plugged into an active research project and then kind of try and get something on the side going that might be a much smaller project on your own? All those are going to have an impact on what your fellowship looks like. And then lastly, just what does it look like, because you're still going to be a clinician there, when you're supervising residents, or even more importantly, are you supervising residents, or are you going to be at the community site because of maybe some of the GME guidelines or the staffing needs of that department? I think those are all some of the big questions that come to mind, but I would definitely lead with the boat question.
All right, Michelle, so what have I forgotten tonight?
No, this is a really comprehensive discussion. I had probably more pointed questions, just two short answers. And to follow up on Jeremy's point about red flags, as you know, I'm always a pessimist, which is red flags, you know, for medical students going to residency, if there are unfilled spots in a program, kind of a red flag, pink flag. But being in a buyer's market, like you guys mentioned, should that be a red flag if, for instance, 1 year they didn't fill all their fellowship spots?
I don't think so, actually, because this is not a perfect process. There's strategies to everything. And as a fellowship director, you could screw that strategy up pretty easily by getting late to the game with EOS fellowships, by not updating that website and branding, you know, yourself very well, by not, maybe you had a conflict, you couldn't come to SAM or ASAP, or you couldn't be there at the fellowship booth that day and really be out there glad handing, you know. So there's ways to screw that up, and then you're not following up because you have some life emergency that popped up, so you're not checking in with the people you've already interviewed, and and saying, hey, do you have any more questions? You know, just really being active, engaged in the process. So there's some strategic things that you can screw up as a fellowship director. So if somebody doesn't fill their spots, I don't hold that against the program at all. I really don't. Luckily, it's just a matter of time until it happens to me. But I don't think that's a red flag. The way it is in residency is very different, I think. The demand's not nearly as high as it is in residency to find a program.
Yeah, I would agree, Michelle. I mean, thinking about folks who have horror stories about not filling a fellowship spot or something like that, I mean, it could happen to any of us, really, because just like you said, I mean, the market has changed a lot in the past 5 years. The new sexy is not necessarily emergency ultrasound fellowships, you know? I mean, maybe it's international, or I don't know what the next thing is, wilderness. I'm reading residency applications right now, and I'm trying to sense what that next thing is going to be where all the beautiful people are doing it.
They're all coming to social media and digital scholarship is where they're going.
Well, which, hence, I guess, Dean Fox's multimedia education fellowship. So there you go. He's yet again a trailblazer.
That's funny. So the second question I have is, you know, if I was a resident graduating now, you have totally sold me on an emergency ultrasound fellowship. Like, I now really wish I'd done it. But what about people who don't have great mentors right now? Do you have a place they can go to? Like, SAM's got that e-advisor for med students. Do we send them all to just you two and just give them your, you know, home address and phone numbers? What do we do here?
You know, I think that Mike and Matt with the ultrasound podcast, I don't know how much you've heard, but they do such an amazing job with that, that if I was a medical student, I mean, if I was a resident curious about going into, you know, looking at this ultrasound business, and I didn't have anybody at my institution who was my immediate mentor, I mean, I would go there. That's the first place I'd go. And Lolly Garabagian has a wonderful website as well that she calls all of the ultrasound websites. So you can see along the right-hand side all of the cool free and open access ultrasound on her website. So I think between those two things, then I think I would get a lot of mentorship. There's plenty of content there between those two to really dive deep and understand what it means to do an ultrasound fellowship.
So that's ultrasoundpodcast.com with Mike and Matt, and then there's Lale over at sonospot.com. It sounds like you just kind of threw those three under the bus, so I'm just going to post their phone numbers up
do it
if they want career advice.
There you go.
Okay. I would. I really look up to both those people tremendously, and the amount of positive influence they've had on our subspecialty has been enormous. Mike and Matt have somewheres of 40,000 downloads a month to their podcast in 180 countries, and so I mean, they just reach so many people through that medium. It's amazing, and it's funny. I listen to it all. I can't wait till the next episode comes out. I love it. I learn something all the time from those guys. Yeah. It's wonderful. They have all these guest people on there too, and that's where I'd tell people to go. Those two places I'd start. There's lots of other wonderful things. I don't mean to diss the other stuff out there, but I think those are two really good, fun, interactive places to go.
And I mean, a lot of places, I think AIUM and some other places are trying to do some kind of virtual student mentor communities. That AIUM is the American Institute of Ultrasound and Medicine. I think what Fox is saying is right on, is that there is so much social media presence, especially there's a big ultrasound presence out there that, I mean, if you hook into that, you can get the learning and the teaching, and then some of the virtual communities that are out there, you can interact with these people. And Mike and Matt have done a great job of sort of sponsoring, I think, to their Castle Fest event. They've even done sort of like scholarships or brought either medical students or residents in. I can't remember which one it was, but I know they've waived the registration fee for people like that. So that's another opportunity, I think, that's out there.
Great.
Great to know.
All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap up our hour together. This was awesome, you guys. I just like Michelle, I learned a ton, really, about this. I'm going to be so much better helping my residents. Thank you. And as a specific thank you, as we always do, tradition here, is to give you guys a little bit of free air time to just talk about how great your programs are. So we're going to start with famous Dr. Fox. I want you to tell me something I don't know about UC Irvine's ultrasound program.
Oh, that's a good question. I think we have a very multimodal ultrasound program going on here where it starts the first day of medical school and it goes all the way through. We have residency training in it, fellowship training in it, and then we have 12 different departments in the hospital that now are credentialed to perform point-of-care ultrasound throughout the whole institution. And so I think what you see here, to plug my own situation here, is that there's just a very wide acceptance of point-of-care ultrasound in the whole the whole gamut, and that is interdisciplinary with the nurses. It's with like 12 different departments. It's everywhere. We have a lot of support and love for the use of ultrasound at the point of care, not just in the emergency department, but throughout the whole institution. So I think that's kind of the how I'd like to sort of sign off and say that, you know, it's not just within one little silo, but it's like everywhere. And so that's why it's a lot of fun to be at a place where, for example, when we do our video QA every week, we're QAing studies from all over the place. And so we see the intensivists doing, you know, geeking out with all this hemodynamic measurements up in the ICU and go to some musculoskeletal thing. And it's cool to have that kind of multimodal distribution of it. So that's why I like it, because I'm such an ultrasound geek. We just got a TE probe too. And so maybe that's what I want to make my fellows do, get their TE boards rather than RDMS, get their TE boards. So I'm about to dive down deep into this TE world. So I'm excited about that.
Well,
In my world, I equate the U and UCI to be ultrasound. Like, it just seems to be a universal thing there. Like, we'll say ultrasound can identify. There you go, UCI. it's everywhere. It's crazy.
That's funny. That was good, Michelle.
You like that? It just came out of here.
I did like
that. I'm honored.
You know, residents, if there's, I don't know how you wouldn't know about Irvine and the Fox if you were going into ultrasound. He was very generous in his comments about some other really great people out there. But man, like, is there a gold standard in ultrasound in emergency medicine? It's got to be behind the orange curtain. I mean, that is an amazing program. You really, you deserve lots and lots of credit, Chris. That place is outstanding. You are visionary. And I can only imagine how awesome it is to be your fellow. So residents, go check out the Anteaters and beautiful Irvine with its beautiful everything. You'll come out a wizard.
All right, Mike, I'll be looking for your application next week on EUS.
Yeah, you know, I mean, every time I do one of these, I have that moment where I think, should I just give it all up and start again? And then I come to terms with that. All right, so Jeremy, I want you to do the same. Tell me something I don't know about Vanderbilt's ultrasound fellowship program.
Absolutely. We are one of the newer emergency ultrasound fellowships, so I certainly, nor would I even try to compare. I mean, I remember when I was looking at fellowships, California was pretty much off the radar to a certain extent. So I've known about UCI for a while, but Vanderbilt, I think we've done it, and we've done it really well here. We've been around for really only about 3 or 4 years, but we've got a really solid core dedicated group of fairly young clinical educators. I mean, we're known at Vanderbilt for our education. We get some fantastic residents. I love our residents, and you get to work with them every day. And it's very much focused on teaching our fellows how is it that you teach this skill, emergency ultrasound? And not just emergency ultrasound, that's translatable to really almost any kind of psychomotor clinically related skill. One thing that we're really proud of and I'm really passionate about and dedicated to, we have a very strong global medicine program at Vanderbilt within our emergency medicine department. There's a whole residency that we help run in Guyana in South America. So right on the coast, it's one of the only emergency medicine residencies in the Caribbean nations, and certainly in terms of English-speaking countries also. And we have residents that go down, our fellows that are global health fellows, go down and serve as assistant program directors there. And we've now had about, I think, 3 or 4 years of residence down there. So one thing that we do is every year, generally, you know, in the deep midwinter, which is not as bad as Chicago, but it certainly gets cold enough down here, we'll go down and we'll do basically a week-long course, an intensive, where we'll work hand in hand with those residents there. Our residents at Vanderbilt actually won one of these like video contests, and with the money they had from that, they bought an ultrasound machine for that residency program in Guyana. So that's the ultrasound machine that they've used there. And we'll go down, we'll bring some other ultrasound machines that we get donated or bring some of our own, and the pathology and the sort of the vast array of patients that you see there is so different, and you really see what a tool ultrasound can be, especially in those limited resource settings. You are there hours and hours in a very hot, non-air-conditioned emergency department, working side by side with these residents and nurses down there, and just the staff who are amazing. But it's a really great opportunity to both teach ultrasound, where you almost become the diagnostician for the hospital, but also really kind of hone your clinical usage of the skill while you're down there. And so our last fellow actually last year actually spent a whole month down there. We kind of finagled his schedule, and he's now kind of bridging the divide between our divisions in global medicine and emergency ultrasound. So we're looking for some pretty cool stuff to come out of that in the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, that's awesome. You guys certainly have tons of resources at Vandy and in all kinds of areas, but to be able to marry some of those across disciplines, and I mean, that's just going to make that young fellowship program, as you called it, it's still a great one. You know, it's going to make it take off. So that's great stuff.
We're excited.
All right. Well, residents, check out the Commodores. With that, I think we're going to close the panel. It was a long but very, very good hour, and I'm so grateful to both Dr. Fox and Dr. Boyd. Michelle, thank you for hosting us.
Sounds good. Happy Coffee Day, everyone.
Happy National Coffee Day.
Awesome.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Emergency Medicine Match Advice. You can view any of our episodes for free on Allium's YouTube channel, or if you prefer, listen to the episodes as Allium podcasts on SoundCloud. Also, check out summaries of our episodes as blog posts on Allium.com and in the publication A User's Guide to the Allium EM Match Advice series in the June 2017 issue of the Western Journal of Emergency Medicine. We love to hear from our listeners. Post your questions or comments for any of our episodes on Allium.com. Thanks for joining us.